chances are you've seen the night sky before. Thou looketh at the heavens, what dost thou see? It is likely that one sees a few or a few thousand, depending on how dark your skies are, stars, specifically glimmering stars, some shining brighter than others, some orange, some red, some blue, some massive, some small, some luminous, some dim. It is likely that you have seen at least a somewhat dark night sky sometime in your past life. As I assume most of you guys have gone camping or hiking or biking, sometimes or often, if you are similar to I, during the night. In the northern winter, the night sky is bedazzling your eyes with thousands of points of beauty, as it does in the summer, of course. In the northern winter, the brightest of the stars show their peculiar brilliance and luminance to our eyes. I like to think of Sirius, Regulus, Adhara, Betelgeuse, Rigel, Aldebaran, Procyon, Capella, Bellatrix, Alnitak, Alnilam, and Mintaka as stars, as examples of stars that all showcase their complexion during these months. In the northern summer, the Milky Way, the dense band of stars that appears to us as a glimmering wave of milk, conveys its own particular brilliance. In the northern summer, the brilliantly lit Deneb, Vega, Altair, Antares, Arcturus, Seder, and the great stars of Sagittarius and Ursa Major all dominate our vision. Upon seeing this prodigious assemblage of nuclear fusion, our brains begin to fail to understand the immensity of the universe in which we live. Even when gazing upon the 3,000 meager stars visible in our night sky, we are humbled by the formidable collection which exists above our heads. Few of us realize that there are yet many more stars and types of stars lurking in the shadows of the stellar immensities lying above. This episode and the next episode will deal specifically with those types of stars, many of which lie underneath our brains, underneath our eyes, and underneath our noses. So as it may have been expected, this chapter is to cover the stars, and the subsequent chapter, the points of light which inspire the greatest of our poets and relieve the hardest of our depressions. If you're tuning into this at night and it is clear, I ask you to look outside. What really do you see? Do you see nothing or do you see stars? I assume you probably see stars. So if so, what do those stars look like? Are some brighter than others? Do some appear larger than others? Do some appear to have different colors than others? Do some appear to glimmer more than others? Questions like these can help indicate the classification of a star. At least it did for a very long time until we actually had very significantly better technology that allowed for us to be able to look at the stars in a greater magnitude and be able to actually distinguish very peculiar and very tiny and discrete differences between respective stars. In this chapter, the different types of stars will be identified and explained that include the main sequence, which is like spectral classes from left to right on the HR diagram, O through M stars. That's basically what the main sequence is. The non-main sequence giants, the non-main main sequence bright giants and supergiants, and then the non-main sequence hypergiants. And in the next episode, we'll be covering the extreme stars, and that will be an interesting episode. Without further ado, let's discuss these points of light and distinguish the crazy from the normal. First, we're going to start with the very obvious and most common star that comprises, I think it's like 90% of the stars in the observable universe, and that is the main sequence star. The main sequence star is completely comprised of the fact that it fuses hydrogen into helium. Every main sequence star fuses hydrogen into helium and nothing else. Once it fuses helium into other things, it has core contraction, which causes a helium flash, which results in the extension of the outer layers of the star, resulting in it being a red giant, bright giant, supergiant, or hypergiant. But anyways, let's get into the main sequence. So the term main sequence is quite an umbrella term, of course. This term describes types of stars that form a distinctive band on a plot known as the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. I'm sure you know what that is. But to explain it, it is a relatively simple graphical representation of the stars and their spectral classifications that is obtained from plotting the surface temperature in Kelvin specifically. So we don't do that centigrade craziness or that Fahrenheit even more craziness. And obviously Kelvin is directly, temperature is directly correlated with color against luminosity. So in terms of absolute magnitude, if you know what absolute magnitude is, if you don't know what it is basically the apparent brightness or luminosity of a star at the exact distance of 10 parsecs or 32.6 light years. We can do some calculations to get how that absolute magnitude pertains to us. We can actually calculate to see what it would be like there, because we can't, obviously, we're not 32.6 light years away from every star in the universe, so we don't really have that exact number. We can't use our own apparent magnitude to basically distinguish stars from one another in that situation. The main sequence is composed of a vast variety of stars existing from the relatively small, cool, and dim stars, specifically the red dwarfs, that are long-living and will fuse hydrogen to helium for much longer than even the sun will, so much longer than the sun's lifetime, all the way to the massive, luminous, hot, and short-lived blue giants, supergiants, and hypergiants. I like to think, whenever I think of a blue hypergiant, I think of Icarus, the most distant star ever discovered. The major notable characteristic of main sequence stars is that they are all currently in the process of fusing hydrogen into helium. As I said earlier, any star currently fusing hydrogen to helium, specifically only in its core, because you can still fuse hydrogen into helium in other regions of the star in some cases, is considered a main sequence star. Once a star begins fusing helium to carbon and other elements, it leaves the main sequence and becomes a non-main sequence giant, supergiant, bright giant, supergiant, or hypergiant, or big thing. The characteristics of the stars in the main sequence depend entirely on their position in the main sequence. So, like the sun, for example, the star that powers quite literally everything on our planet and everything in our solar system, is a G2V spectral class star, meaning that it is a slightly yellow dwarf, but it appears white in the night sky. Not in our night sky. In the night sky of like a place without an atmosphere. So the sky of Pluto, it appears as white because there's no atmosphere. The atmosphere diffracts that blue light and thus giving it a slightly yellow color, but it is really pretty much just white. It's pretty much just white. The sun lies near the middle of the main sequence, containing a surface temperature of approximately 5800 Kelvin. If you really want to be exact, it's 5778 Kelvin, with an absolute magnitude of around 4.83, so that is not that high. The absolute magnitude of the sun is characterized by a zero on the HR diagram, because we have to be anthropocentric. Of course, unsurprisingly, we have to be anthropocentric. We couldn't just say -1, -2. But even then, it's still not really that anthropocentric. The absolute magnitude of the sun is characterized by a zero. I already said that. And other stars graphed on the HR diagram are represented in brightness based on their luminosity against the sun. So that's a big part of it. Stars on the upper branch of the main sequence are known as blue giants. These stars are newly formed and unstable stars that arose with the collapse of an immense molecular cloud. The star is significantly larger, brighter, and younger than the sun. So, like, the sun is around 4.5 to 5 billion years old. We know that because of carbon dating and the fact that it is halfway through its hydrogen to helium life cycle. We know it because of a lot. We have a lot of evidence for it. While some blue hypergiants, on the other hand, don't live for 4 to 5 billion years. They don't even live for 10. They don't even live for a billion. In many cases, they can live for less than 10 million years. Blue giants can be anywhere from 10 times to 1 million times brighter than the sun, and are among the hottest stars in the universe, not quite, with surface temperatures of some massive stars reaching upwards of 30,000 Kelvin. Now, there's another star that I encourage you guys to look up. I was unfortunately not able to add it in either of the episodes that I'm crafting right now, but I highly suggest you look it up if you want to see an extreme version of a very hot star, and that is the Wolf-Rayet star. So the Wolf, you know how to spell Wolf, dash R-A-Y-E-T star. So obviously, those are the hottest stars in the universe that we know of course. And they're very interesting, but unfortunately I was never able to get a chance to add them in because simply my episodes were getting too long. I mean, when you're pushing 10 pages for one episode, you have a problem, because then you can't even speak out of turn. You can't even just like go off on a tangent at all. And it's fun to go off on a tangent when you're making a podcast episode. It's just how it be. On the other hand of the spectrum are the red dwarfs, which comprise literally 90% of the stars in the universe. They comprise a lot of them, a vast majority, yet we can't even see many, if any, notable red dwarfs in the night sky. And, of course, that makes sense, because the most common star has to be the least sizable and the least cool. I mean, it is the most cool, but that's pun intended and literally speaking. But still, it's unfortunate. Red dwarfs are far slower burning and far cooler than their blue giant main sequence cousins. These stars can often live upwards of 100 billion years, and in most cases, many trillions of years, and are often relatively cool with surface temperatures rarely exceeding 3,000 to 3,200 Kelvin. Red dwarf stars have such long lifespans that there has not yet been a single documented case of a red dwarf burning itself out. It is believed that it will not be able to, it will not achieve nucleosynthesis once its helium core contracts. It is believed that it will undergo a similar planetary nebula white dwarf significance, but except there will be no helium flashes. It'll just kind of die out. It won't be able to perform hydrogen fusion anymore, because the only thing left in its core is helium, and that's basically what's going to happen to it. So it has a pretty depressing end of its life on its hands. The life cycle of a main sequence star depends entirely on its position in the main sequence. For smaller stars, their lifespans will be longer, and for larger stars, their lifespans will be shorter. For stars that are greater than 8 solar masses, they will continue nuclear fusion until their iron-rich core explodes, or actually, opposite of that, implodes into itself and results in a supernova. Or with hypergiants, specifically in giants, I believe it is 25 solar masses and higher, gravitational collapse often and exclusively leads to the formation of black holes. Again, it depends entirely upon the size, and also, to go off on a tangent, when it leads to the formation of a black hole, there is absolutely no supernova, so it's not the worst thing to live very close to a very supermassive star, but except the fact that you're going to have to deal with a stellar black hole in not too long. But otherwise, not too bad. Yeah, that's not bad at all. For stars with masses lesser than that of 8 solar masses, they will begin helium fusion and exhaust their helium. But that will be it. At this point, when their cores are filled with carbon, they do not continue to burn and begin to experience gravitational collapse. Although their collapse does not result in a massive explosion, but rather a white dwarf, the dead core of the dead star, and a vibrant planetary nebula. So the big thing that happens with a white dwarf is that it is not able to contract because of something known as electron degeneracy pressure. We will discuss that in detail, and when I mean detail, I mean great detail in the next episode, but I'm going to give you guys a little bit of an example right now. So when a white dwarf contracts, it experiences something known as electron degeneracy pressure. We discussed this already. The thing about it, it basically, the Pauli exclusion principle states that no electron in the same volume can be in the same energy state as another electron. So basically, you start with a ground state, which is the zero ground state, so the level on the very bottom of the graph. I like to represent this by the inner ring, the first orbital of a, like, a uranium atom. And because of the Pauli exclusion principle, they will continue to increase their energy states, because electrons will not be able to be in the same space, same state, so they'll have to increase their energy state, and thus their energy output, which basically creates a pressure on its own, and the quantum effects of it basically act against gravity and support the support the white dwarf itself. Because remember that we have this gravitational pressure versus radiation pressure, and without the radiation pressure, you just have the gravitational collapse, and without nuclear fusion, there is no radiation pressure. So the big thing is, what do we have? Like, what do we have? We need to have something that actually will be able to fix the problem with the gravitational collapse, and thus electron degeneracy pressure and the Pauli exclusion principle define that very well for us. These white dwarfs will live for trillions of years, a long time, and the black dwarfs that result from them will live for much longer than that. And also another thing is that they do not necessarily implode. The thing that happens with a star, with a smaller star that only can fuse helium to carbon and can't go past helium fusion, they do not experience quite a supernova or anything. They actually, basically they have something called helium flashes, which is just a sudden significant increase in the amount of fusion of helium into other elements. And this basically causes like a shock wave that ruptures the star and causes a lot of its contents, not its innards, but rather its outards, to basically be ejected into space away from the core of the star and outside of the basically escape velocity outside of the gravitational bounds of that star. And as a result, well, that's basically what happens over time. And then the white dwarf, once it's completely done with fusion, we know exactly what happens. All main sequence stars are characterized by currently undergoing hydrogen fusion, meaning the fusion of hydrogen into helium. Once a star begins fusing helium into heavier elements, they leave the main sequence, of course. And then obviously, considering a vast majority of stars in the main sequence are in the universe, are main sequence stars, to be exact, literally 90% of all the stars in the universe are. There are quite a few main sequence stars that we can indicate. Some notable examples that I think of of main sequence stars include the Sun, Alpha Centauri, Toulmin, Alpha Beta Centauri, Rigel, Rigel Centaurus or Centaurus or whatever it is, Toulmin, which is Beta Rigel Centaurus, and then Rigel, Canopus, and also the three stars of Orion's belt. From the east in the northern night sky, there's Alnitak, Alnilam, and Mintaka. The non-main sequence giant is a common type of star that has exhausted its core-bound hydrogen fuel and left the main sequence. There are a few different types of non-main sequence giants that are to be discussed in this chapter. These include the giant, bright giant, the supergiant, and the hypergiant. The first of these is the giant is the smallest of the non-main sequence giant branches. This type of star is characterized as deriving from a main sequence star that is larger than a red dwarf but smaller than a blue giant. This particular giant has exhausted all of the hydrogen fuel in its core, as all non-main sequence giants have, and has the ability to fuse helium into heavier elements, unlike red dwarfs. The main distinguishing characteristics of this particular star type relative to the other giants is the fact that this star cannot undergo carbon or oxygen fusion, and that it experiences a different death than its supergiant and hypergiant counterparts. The giant star exists in a region of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram known as the red giant branch, in which it moves from the main sequence to the horizontal branch upon exhausting all of hydrogen fuel, and then from the horizontal branch to the asymptotic giant branch upon exhausting all helium fuel, and it doesn't last long in the asymptotic giant branch. Well, asymptotic, technically, because it's an asymptote, but I like to say asymptotic. It's asymptote, like asymptotic, boom. The life cycle of a typical giant is similar to that of an intermediate main sequence star. The star begins as a protostar. If you want more information, see episode 16 or chapter 16 if you're reading this. But you're not reading this because this is a podcast. And evolves into performing hydrogen fusion. The star continues on in its hydrogen fusion until the core of the star is entirely helium. At this point, the core of the star experiences gravitational collapse and condenses to the point at which it can perform helium fusion. When this occurs, a region beyond the core of the star begins performing hydrogen fusion itself, and as a result of the increased radiation pressure and also various helium flashes, the pressure overtakes the gravitational pressure and vastly increases the size of the star. The star at this point is removed from the main sequence and becomes a giant star. If the star contains a mass below or around 8 solar masses, then it will continue fusing helium into heavier elements until those heavier elements, namely carbon and oxygen, occupy the entire core. Once this occurs, the star is not able to perform fusion in its core, and after a series of helium flashes that occur throughout its main non-main sequence lifetime, it will eject the entirety of its non-core material to form a beautiful planetary nebula, which only exists for 30,000 years, apparently. And the remaining core of its star, known as a white dwarf, will exist for the next human eternity, but it too will eventually fizz away. As was spoken of earlier, the typical intermediate mass giant star will experience a death significantly different from that of the high mass supergiants, and even more different than the hypergiant. The death of an intermediate mass giant star is far more spread out and far less instantaneous and violent as with bright giant supergiants and hypergiants. The intermediate star undergoes a series of helium flashes, which are essentially brief intervals of runaway helium to carbon nuclear fusion, occurring in the cores of stars existing with masses of 0.8 to 2 solar masses. So the sun will be one of those. These helium flashes cause significant amounts of star matter to emanate from the gravitational bounds of the star. And over time, the resulting effect is the formation and formulation of a planetary nebula, specifically, like, notably the Dumbbell Nebula, which was the first nebula I ever imaged by itself. Additionally, as the core runs out of helium, it cannot collapse further to fuse heavier elements. Also, the Dumbbell Nebula was the first nebula that I ever observed by itself as well. The dead core of the star is basically all that remains after the non-core material emanates from the core. This star is known as a white dwarf and will generally remain a white dwarf until eventually the white dwarf itself dies out. In some very rare cases, the white dwarf can reach critical mass, which is around 1.4 solar masses as highlighted by the Chandra-Seeker limit. Apparently I always said that wrong. At this point, it'll form a type 1a supernova and become a neutron star, which is an even more extreme dead core of a dead star. I personally like to imagine Sirius B, the white dwarf companion of Sirius A, the brightest star in the night sky, experiencing a type 1a supernova and becoming a neutron star. If that happened, it would undoubtedly mean death and destruction for the human species and for all of the planet, because it is only 7 light years away, and it is 1.018 solar masses, and the 1.4 solar mass limit is very feasible, because Sirius is a 2 solar mass star, and it is emanating, and stellar winds are emanating the mass of Sirius away from itself, and a lot of it is being captured by Sirius B, but the chances of it are literally astronomically low, that it will actually go supernova and turn into a neutron star. The first couple typical giants that come to my own mind when thinking of red giants include Aldebaran, the brightest star or even object in the constellation Taurus, and also Arcturus, the brightest star and object in the constellation Bootes, and the fourth brightest star in the night sky, and the second brightest star in the northern night sky. There are many others, including, but not most certainly not limited to, 42 Draconis, Gamma Aquilae, Delta Eridani, among many others. Bright giants and super giants both are in similar stages of life to the giant stars. These stars have left the main sequence and are now fusing helium to heavier elements. A notable difference surrounding the evolution of these larger giants, notably the bright giants and the super giants, is that they transition from hydrogen fusion to helium fusion more smoothly than their lesser mass companions. These stars do not experience severe subsequent and substantial helium flashes that result in the loss of stellar mass, but instead do not experience helium flashes. These stars very smoothly fuse helium into carbon without the crazy helium flashes. And furthermore, once these stars have fused all the helium in their cores into carbon, oxygen, and neon, they do not experience the same core collapse as the smaller giants do. Instead of not being able to undergo heavier element fusion like the typical giant stars do, they are able to undergo carbon fusion and subsequent fusion like silicon fusion, neon fusion, all that crazy stuff, leading all the way to the fusion to iron, not of iron, the fusion to iron. Once a star reaches a full iron ash core, which is the iron, unfusible iron remnants of the core, it is unable to fuse further elements. Iron is not only too heavy, but one of the most stable, I think it is the most stable element in the universe. So it is basically fused, it is impossible for it to be fused in the core of a star. It requires an extremely violent event, which we discussed in chapter 16 or episode 16. Thus its core contracts further, and once reaching critical mass, not even that, no. The fact that it is not able to resist the gravitational pressure of its own mass results in it reaching the Chandrasekhar limit and becoming a neutron star. And then, and basically when this, when the core collapses, it basically collapses as far as it can go. It's a very violent collapse. But when it collapses down to a neutron star, it collapses so far that the strong nuclear force does not even beat it there, beat it to actually, mitigating the collapse. So when the strong nuclear force finally takes effect, essentially, the star basically expands out. It contracts so far that it is forced to expand out. So I like to think of, like when you have like this, like a bouncy ball or something, like a stress ball, you basically smash your hand on it. Like you really crunch it up really far. But then after that, like once you go away from it, it expands again. It's the same concept. But what happens is it causes massive shock waves. And these shockwaves essentially rip the star apart and blast out all of its contents, specifically plasma, at 5% of the speed of light. So, yeah, very, very, very not good. Obviously, its life is significantly different and often significantly shorter than a red giant, and it experiences a far more evolutionary stages and fuses much heavier elements than its smaller siblings or cousins. A red bright giant or supergiant is currently in the midst of helium and heavier element fusion. As with the typical giant stars, the supergiants too have left the main sequence and are instead near the top of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. The larger a star is, the faster it fuses helium into heavier elements. Thus, a sun-sized star has a longer lifespan than that of its supergiant counterparts. The supergiant lives for a significantly shorter portion of time than the sun will live, and even less so beyond hydrogen fusion. Because most supergiant stars have masses beyond 8 solar masses, they will not experience the same death that their sub-8 solar mass siblings experience. We've discussed exactly what happens. If you want to see more explanations of this, look into episode 16. There's a lot of information on it there. The supernova that results from this results in the creation, the fomentation, or the genesis of every element above iron. There are a few other cases in which this happens, but notably, the most notable of it is supernova. So the uranium that we use for fission was once an iron atom or a big atom in a supernova, a star gone supernova. Unlike some of the other stars, especially the ones we'll discover in the next episode, there are actually a significant number of notable stars in the night sky that are, in fact, supergiants. The most obvious one that comes to mind, specifically my mind, is Betelgeuse or Alpha Orionis. which is one of the brightest stars in the night sky, and the second brightest star or object in the constellation Orion, and is very well known for its believed potential supernova explosion, which never happened, in the late 2019, early 2020 era, which made global news and stunned the scientific and global amateur community. Another few notable supergiant stars include Antares, Epsilon Pegasi, among many others. Red supergiant stars are quite rare, but their luminosity makes them very obvious in the night sky, even from significant distances, and thus they contain some of the most notable and brightest stars in the night sky. Antares is one of my favorite stars. Antares is my second favorite star, outside of Vega. Vega is by far my favorite star. The last one we're going to discuss is very shortly is a non-main sequence hypergiant. This last of the star types on our list is not going to be explained in detail because there's merely only one significant distinguishing characteristic of the hypergiant star that contrasts it from supergiants, bright giants, and typical giants. Again, of course, how it dies. While many supergiants can experience the same occurrences in its death, this phenomenon is far more profound in hypergiants, so like I'm thinking 25 solar masses and higher. For stars that are exceptionally massive and whose cores are as well, their cores not only reach the Chandrasekhar limit during their core collapse, but also the Oppenheimer-Volkoff limit, or basically their cores are already 2.3 solar masses, which is the upper limit of a neutron star mass. So their cores are above 2.3 solar masses. And as a result, once that radiational pressure is done, it's going to go straight down to a black hole. It is going to collapse so far that not even the strong nuclear force can defeat it. Or actually, it's 2.17 solar masses. My fault. It's not 2.3, it's 2.17. These stars, upon collapsing into a black hole, do not produce any supernova whatsoever because there's no pressure wave, no shock wave that emanates from that core region as the nuclear force fights against it, because the nuclear force does not fight against it, because it can't. Even so, these hypergiants are often exceptionally luminous and incredible. Even though they don't leave any trace of their existence after that, they just swallow everything up. And there are really no notable hypergiants that are very visible in our night sky, but I'm sure you know the two notable stars I'm going to talk about, which include UY Scuti and VY Canis Majoris, which are both not anywhere near being visible on planet Earth, because, first of all, they're like 4,500 light years away. But yeah. The stars existed in our society as a source for all our philosophies. Based on what I've read in many, many, many books, including all of Carl Sagan's works and The Discoverers by James R. Borstein, or whatever his name is. I always forget his name. They were not only the source of the seasons and the growing seasons and the calendars, but the guardians of all our greatest triumphs, fears, and aspirations. For hundreds of thousands of years, our ancestors survived off the hominess of the stars, the homeliness and the hominess the stars provided. Navigation relative to Polaris allowed for ancient sailors setting sail on their oceans blue without compasses, a sense of direction. For humanity, the night sky is a sanctuary. It is a view intrinsically connected with the deepest realms of our collective souls. In the divided world in which we live, one of the few opinions we all collectively share together with one another is a great love for the night sky. The night sky and the stars are themselves powerful unifiers. Thank you all for listening, and as always, have a good morning, afternoon, evening, and night. Take care and stay curious.